Welcome to SCI Asia's podcast on environment and policy in Asia. In this podcast series, we invite experts to discuss the many critical and complex environmental challenges in Asia and how to find solutions through policy and partnerships.
Hey everyone, I'm Rajesh Daniel from SCI Asia. I'm joined today by Dr. Danny Marks, who is currently an assistant professor of environmental politics and policy in the School of Law and Government of Dublin City University. Danny's research interests include political ecology, environmental justice, climate governance, and disaster risk reduction. He is especially interested in urban and environmental governance in Southeast Asia. So Danny, welcome to the SCI Asia pod. Today we wanted to chat with you on matters relating to urban climate governance in Asia. What can be done better in terms of urban planning in the context of climate change and climate adaptation? But also especially we wanted to focus on cities. We hope this resonates with your own background in researching urban and climate governance topics.
Thanks, Rajesh. I'm very happy to join this podcast by SEI. It gives me a chance to discuss a number of issues that I've been working on for the past few years. This intersection of urban governance and climate change holds special interest for me. I've conducted research on a number of issues related to it, including urban flood governance, the urban heat island, reducing emissions from urban transport as well. So I look forward to discussing those issues with you.
Excellent. So, Danny, a little bit of context before we dive into specific issues. We do know that cities are often seen as sites for the worst activities and kinds of behavior that contribute to climate change. They encourage car use, they build huge networks of roads, large malls. In fact, a recent UN study showed that although cities cover less than 5% of the globe, some 70% of global resources are consumed in cities, and also more than 70% of global greenhouse gas emissions. But cities are not the only bad guy. They also hold great potential. We do know that many cities, especially in the north, are introducing and implementing climate mitigation and adaptation policies. Of course, this is also a matter of scale. They are doing it because they are smaller, but these can be scaled up. So there is a good, there is a bad. What are your thoughts, Danny, on this dichotomy?
That's a good question. I mean, I think these statistics are definitely suggest that cities are at the forefront of addressing climate change. I mean, both in terms of mitigation, but also adaptation. I mean, about 90% of cities are coastal ones. So when sea level rises, they'll be affected more by flooding and coastal erosion. But also, what's clear from the recent IPCC report is that urgent, rapid, and large-scale action is needed to reduce emissions. I mean, cities can play a key role in reducing emissions, since they control transportation networks, building codes, and water and power lines. But also what's clear is that this issue is particularly pressing in Asia. A majority of the world's carbon emissions originate in this region, but also a number of countries are highly vulnerable to climate change, and including the cities within these countries. I mean, for example, Bangladesh, Philippines, Vietnam, and Cambodia regularly show up in the lists of countries which are most vulnerable to climate change. This region is the most urbanizing region in the whole world. 60% of the growth in urban areas will take place in Asia over the next few decades. But to go back to your question about this dichotomy, cities are the future, particularly here in Asia. I mean, the majority of future humans will live in cities. And so it makes sense that our solutions to climate change will take place in cities too. The cities can also be the solution because mayors are more directly accountable to their constituents. And they face the voters more directly, but also cities are flexible and they can move more quickly than national governments can in terms of rolling out new projects and policies. They can also help set the agenda for elsewhere and at the national level. And finally, cities can experiment on climate solutions. So just to start off, there are a number of ways that cities can quickly reduce their carbon footprints. And in particular, encouraging urban density is one way forward. So making cities greener, more walkable, and implementing nature-based solutions are also ways forward. And some of these solutions are win-win because they don't only reduce carbon emissions, but they also make these cities more resilient to climate risks.
Excellent. That does show both the potential and, as you said, the vulnerability of cities. Before we go into the action part, because you did say that as the IPCC report says, urgent rapid action is required. When we talk about climate and urban governance, what are the gaps in knowledge that we still need to figure out, especially in Southeast Asia, and how do you think they can be addressed?
Okay, so unlike in the US and to a lesser extent Australia, for example, I mean, the science of climate change is not debated. I mean, I think in Southeast Asia, there's widespread agreement that something needs to be done about climate change. I mean, governments have signed up to the Paris Agreement. But at the city level, the problem is these countries are still seen as developing countries, except for, say, Singapore. And so there's the idea that we still need to develop. I mean, that's one way to build our resilience to climate change. But at the same time, we need to reduce climate risks. So, I mean, this means reducing poverty of low-income residents. I mean, there's many of these in major cities in Asia, but also making them more resilient, but also reducing emissions at the same time. And so I think cities have been unable so far to do this. This is I guess you can call this a gap. And so, for example, you still see very high emissions in the transport sector in cities, very high automobile usage in cities like Bangkok, Manila, and Jakarta. I mean, Bangkok's transport emissions are on par or higher than cities such as New York, Tokyo, and London. But also, I mean, there's the push for rapid real estate expansion. And so this has mean building real estate development and flood zones, are filling in of waterways and lakes. I mean, this has been a big issue in Phnom Penh, for example, and Hanoi. And this has increased the risk of flooding. So I guess the larger question is, how can cities in this region still grow and improve people's lives while reducing emissions and making their citizens more resilient? So this is a challenge that must be solved by both at the urban municipal level and also by national governments, I mean, working together. I mean, there's no easy solutions for this. I mean, what's clear, though, is we need rapid decarbonization, for example, from buildings, so retrofitting them, making them more climate-proof. I mean, for example, there's a lot of sunlight in this region. I mean, and so it's very clear that, I mean, these buildings can be designed better, so you reduce electricity uses, or you can make wind flows better, so you reduce air conditioning costs. And so at the same time, I mean, you also need to find ways to reduce automobile usage, so increasing public transport, making it more expensive to drive. And so also making cities, though, more climate proof. So this would mean growing local food, planting trees, restoring wetlands, and rooftop gardens. But also, I think a key issue is making cities more equitable. I mean, studies clearly show that the richest 1%, both in the developing and developed world, emit more than 30 times percent more carbon per person than the poorest 50%. So I think the thing is, we can still reduce poverty while better addressing climate change. So addressing inequality is key within these cities. And so also the key issue is also, how can we invest better in public goods, better public infrastructure such as rail, but also sanitation, public health, and public places like pools, parks, and recreational areas. And then finally, the issue is, how can cities reduce their carbon footprint by using more decentralized renewable energy?
A lot of challenges, a lot of things that can be taken up at the policy level. Just to reflect back, you and I have been in this region for enough number of years to actually see some cities develop. I remember Chiang Mai and Phnom Penh. We were about 15 years ago, we were thinking, okay, or 15, maybe 20 years ago, we were thinking, here's a chance, an opportunity to not be another Bangkok. And yet, they seem to have followed a trajectory where they built many roads, filled it with cars. They did not spend money on public transport. They did remove wetlands. And Phnom Penh, there is an ongoing issue of floods now because they removed the wetlands around the city. So there is this desire to make cities better, and yet they continue to follow this trajectory. Why do you think that is? City planners think, okay, let's do all of these mistakes again?
I think it's to a number of issues. I mean, one is this issue of lock-in. Once you build these roads, I mean, it's kind of inertia that you just keep on going forward this path, that once you expand more, have more infrastructure, you're just going to keep on, you know, going out into these rural areas, expanding and making you, and as you're saying, increasing, you know, air pollution, but also emissions. But also, I think, for example, is the political cycle. Mayors are often elected in short-term political cycles. And so they want to show their voters that they've done something. And so it's much easier for them to show their voters, well, I built new roads, I built flood walls, even those flood walls might move flood risks to other areas, are not really addressed the long-term issues about flooding, because voters can see that. They can see the new shiny buildings and roads, but they can't see the land use planning, which preserves green areas, which can store water. It makes sense. Mayors want to be reelected. But also national governments have pushed these urban governments to follow the national trajectory and trying to promote growth at all costs. And I mean, I guess, I mean, it's still the imperative of trying to push for GDP. I mean, they still use the reason that we're poor. That could be a different narrative. I mean, yes, these countries aren't as wealthy as they are in the developed world, and they still should reduce poverty. But I think it's more about what type of growth you pursue and how equitable it is, and also how green it is. I mean, the good thing is that these cities and countries can learn from what the developed world did or didn't do, and they don't have to follow the same trajectory. So I think there still presents an opportunity there.
I just wanted to come back to something you said earlier. Cities need to develop and also build resilience. Mm-hmm. And we do know that as part of development in this region, especially, cities need housing provision, they need sanitation, waste disposal. And obviously, these are most urgent areas for urban governance. Given that challenge to provide basic urban facilities, how does then one start to integrate or build in climate responses? Is that seen as a distraction for policymakers?
I mean, I think it shouldn't be seen as a distraction. I mean, I think the technical term used often is mainstream climate change. But I mean, I think, especially with the new IPCC report, cities should prioritize climate change and integrate climate change into all of its activities, into all these issues like housing, sanitation, and waste disposal. I mean, housing is a great example of how it can be well integrated. Public housing is urgently needed in almost every major city in Southeast Asia. There's not enough public housing, so it needs to be built. But the way it's built, it should be done with low energy usage. So, for example, I mean, Vienna in Austria has great public housing, and they use very little air conditioning in the summer compared to, say, New York City, even though it reaches similar temperatures. I mean, it's not as hot as it gets here in Southeast Asia, but I mean, still, there's ways to design this public housing in terms of low energy usage, in terms of walkability. I mean, it has to be holistic. So thinking about improving urban density, making these public housing connected to jobs, but also public transport, so emissions can be lowered. But also when you think of waste disposal, I mean, you can have waste to energy systems. I mean, you can use wastewater sludge and capture it for energy. And it can also safely boost agriculture. But also, I mean, you can see the linking that if you have flooding, it also worsens sanitation. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of linkages between these things. But also, I mean, when you think about this, I mean, it's just investing in, I guess, universal social policies, like, for example, guaranteed health care, education, water. I mean, housing, as I already mentioned, social security. I mean, that's just, it's good for many things. I mean, it's good for climate change, but it's also good just for improving well-being overall. And so I think these type of solutions are win-win. But also, I think governments need to now, especially urban governments, think about how can they urgently and on a large scale reduce carbon emissions in all these sectors because of this new report. This is a big red flag. And so I think cities need to redesign and revamp their climate action plans.
Going back to that IPCC report, as you said, there's a red flag. It's more than ever impressed on us the urgency for climate action. In your own reading of it, have you found anything there that has talked specifically about cities in Southeast Asia?
I think, for example, if you look at the section on Southeast Asia, they mentioned, for example, the Mekong Delta is highly vulnerable to a number of issues, particularly sea level rise and coastal erosion due to climate change. But I think also, I mean, it just shows that if you read the report, that there's going to be, I mean, There'll be likely more high precipitation events, which means that flooding will affect cities throughout the region. Droughts are also more likely. So I think cities need to plan for this. I mean, they need to think about how they're going to deal with this issue of water better, and how these cities can better live with water, both the lack thereof or too much water. And so, I mean, that would be increasing drainage capacity, for example, increasing green spaces, which can both retain and store water when there's not enough water, but also help with flooding. And so I think also, for example, what you've seen in Netherlands and Dutch cities, making room for water, and so removing flood walls and dikes, or turning parking garages, for example, into drainage areas and water retention areas. And so I think these are key issues in Southeast Asia, is how to deal with the issue of water.
So far, it seems that when we do refer to cases or examples, it's easier, it seems, to refer to cities in the global north. But that is obviously because, and we know this, that the empirical urban climate governance literature is still dominated by studies from the global north. There is not that much from the global south. Why do you think that is? Should there be more studies, or do we have enough studies? It's just that they're not focusing on the climate and urban governance intersection, as you said.
I think there should be more studies of urban climate governance in the global south. I mean, I think there are a number of reasons for this. One is that there's more funding. There's more research funding from national governments, but also research bodies in the north devoted to these issues of urban climate governance. Also, when you look at the university level sector, I mean, there's fewer programs and classes on this issue, and so there's less training and knowledge on these issues of urban climate governance in the global south. Although I do think this is improving, I think there are more studies and researchers focused on this issue, so it's promising. But I certainly think there's still a gap in this issue, and more can be done.
Definitely true. We do need more studies in the global south about our cities. So that gives us a good idea of the knowledge gaps. We've also talked about policy. Since this is especially a policy podcast on environment, let me focus a little bit more on policy and local governance, especially. Mm-hmm. Because in one of your responses, you said the challenge is, how do you bring the municipal level to work together with the national government? But for a moment, if we talk only of local municipal governance, what do you think are the factors that can enable this to become better? How do city governments, how do municipalities get better at urban governance and local climate action?
I mean, it's a tough challenge, particularly, I mean, with the lack of decentralization in many Southeast Asian countries. But municipal governments, particularly in smaller cities, like secondary cities, they still have quite a bit of independence. I mean, there's less political interference, for example, at the national level. I mean, for example, with Bangkok, especially if the Bangkok governor is from a different political party than the national government, the national government's going to try to stop or hinder the Bangkok governor from implementing policies because he or she doesn't want the governor to look too good, because it would, you know, hurt their re-election chances. But at these secondary levels, I think there's a lot of opportunity for social learning, to learn from what other cities have done. But I think it also requires a number of different actors to come together. I mean, I think you need some expertise from scientists, but also non-scientists, social scientists, even in the humanities. And so these people can think about what are solutions, but also I think you need to build a coalition with, for example, particularly low-income groups, because they are the ones who suffer the most from climate risks, and the ones who can offer solutions and know best how to make climate responses fairer within their cities. And so you have a coalition of experts, low-income communities, but also private sector leaders as well are needed. And so basically you need these different groups to come together to talk with the government. And so because basically you need to have a widespread buy-in. I mean, what that climate change is a major issue. And that, I mean, these are different solutions that can be proposed, and then to come together for compromises and this kind of collective action which is needed at the local level. And also, as you talk about learning from what cities have done or not done, and then I think then you can think of solutions.
Which brings me to my last question. Among all of this governance and climate action, I know that your own interests have also rested a lot on equitable governance. I know your research has focused a lot on equitable governance and how attention can be focused on vulnerable communities. Your research on the floods in Thailand showed how the burden of disaster risks is not shared equally, and especially between urban and suburban or rural communities. You also explored the notions of disaster justice. How can we bring this more so that once again, it's not the poorest or the most vulnerable that are affected by policies to do with urban and climate governance?
Well, that's a great question. Just to briefly summarize my research on the floods, I use this idea of disaster justice to look at how there was two different notions of responses to the floods. I mean, one was this more hierarchical notion of justice, which is basically the idea that some places and people should be protected based on their position in society and at the expense of others. And so this was promoted by the elites, for example. And at the other side was this more, egalitarian notion of disaster justice, where people should share burdens and have equitable access to the distribution of risk. And so many communities protested in Bangkok during the floods and sought to push for a fairer response to the flooding. So when you think about at the wider level of climate change, I mean, a good example is this notion of double injustice within cities, is that poor people in Southeast Asia, they take the bus or they ride motorbikes, they live in smaller homes, they use little or no air conditioning. You could even also say they eat less meat, but they live in the most vulnerable areas. They live along canals or railroad tracks, and so the ones who are most affected by flooding, or they could say they also live closer to factories, and so they suffer from air pollution. And in contrast, the wealthy, they drive the most. They have the bigger homes, they take flights, and they're better protected. I mean, they live in areas which have more flood walls and so forth. And so this is a double injustice, both in terms of adaptation and mitigation at the city level. And so when you think about climate response, how do you address this double injustice? I mean, because often the benefits and costs are even. And many times we're seeing climate policies actually exacerbating or redistributing inequality, and so creating unfair outcomes. I mean, a good example is after the 2011 floods in Bangkok, the government, national government, raised roads around the outskirts of Bangkok. So this protected Bangkok more, but those outside Bangkok, which are farmers, for example, in Nakhon Pathom or Ayutthaya, they're now exposed to more flood risk. Or in Manila, for example, they filled in many waterways to build more residential areas and shopping malls. But because low-income communities lived along these waterways, they were evicted into spaces which are farther away from the work and lower quality housing. So these projects are done without consulting these groups. It's also a problem of cost-benefit analysis. I mean, these models often lead to helping those who are better off. So when you think about climate policies, we need to ask about resilience for whom? I mean, because a lot of times it's just building urban climate resilience, but you need to unpack this. Who benefits from these resilience projects? But also in terms of mitigation, who is responsible for reducing emissions? And if anybody will lose jobs, for example, if you close down a coal-powered plant, how will this transition be made fairly? Will there be job retraining programs to help workers who lose jobs? So what must be done is we share risks and burdens equitably in terms of climate change, or even better, in terms of thinking about the most vulnerable. They should be the focus in terms of building resilience. And those who are the elite, because they are the ones who have the most responsibility. And so we need to think about how can we make this happen? And so you need to think about bottom-up movements, which empower these groups, incorporate their voices, but also design policies which incorporate redistribution. But I think also we need to think about why does this exist? I mean, in Southeast Asia and beyond, we have injustices in this ecological crisis. In terms of climate change, but many other problems like air pollution, because the political systems themselves are corrupted and unfair. And so elites have managed to capture political systems. So we need to have better democracies in general. We need to kick big money out of politics, dismantle monopolies, manage collective resources as commons as much as possible. And then only this way can we address this double injustice of climate change.
That was an excellent response, Danny, and it's a very good way to end this podcast on policy, that we should always be looking out for the most vulnerable, the poorest, who are most likely to suffer policies focusing on urban climate governance. With that, we can wrap this up, Danny. Let me thank you once again for joining us, giving us of your time and expertise, and I wish you all the best.
Oh, thank you, Rajesh. Thanks for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to SEI Asia's podcast on environment and policy in Asia. For more information on these topics, guests, and our work, please visit our website on www.sei.org.